This is Gary Hayes, and I'm interviewing L.W. Clement at Dr. Badger's house at 11005 East Chestnut in Sun Lakes, Arizona, on June 3rd, 2000 at 1:30 p.m. Mr. Clement, can you please, excuse me, state your years of service and the rank that you retired as?
Okay, I entered the service in November of 1957. And I retired in 1982 with 26 years of service. I retired as a Colonel 06.
And what was your branch?
Ordnance Corps.
Okay. And you went to Vietnam at what time in your career?
I went to, from the Command and General Staff College, I entered the, I went to Vietnam in June of 1967. And I returned in June of 1968.
Okay. And what unit were you in the first time?
Well, the first unit I joined in Vietnam was the 69th Maintenance Battalion, when I was the materiel officer for the battalion. And then I the second 6 months, about December, I was selected to be the commander of the 63rd Maintenance Battalion to take the battalion up on the DMZ about 11 miles to Quang Tri Marine Base, and that's where I assembled the battalion. I had five companies, like 1,450 men or so, and there to support the northern First Corps region of Vietnam.
The first 6 months, you were the materiels officer. What is the function of a materiel? What do you do?
Well, in a maintenance battalion, we support all the various commodities. Automotive, tank automotive, electronics, and there is a materiel section that has commodity-oriented officers in each one of those areas, and it's basically how the battalion operates day-to-day, all the day-to-day operations of the battalion. Those units involved in maintenance of tanks and automotive and artillery, and electronics components, refrigeration, whatever it takes. And these commodities, there are like six officers in each in a materiel section, and each one of them support various commodities. And I was just the overseer of the all battalion operations in the various maintenance areas.
So you are combat service support?
Yes, right, combat service support.
And what would be a daily life? What was a day in life like for you? What was a normal mission?
Well, every day, and first thing in the morning, I met with the most of the six officers came into my office, and we had a cup of coffee, and we outlined what we were going to be doing that day and what they were going to be doing that day and where our problems were in our particular region of Cameron Bay and what we were going to be supporting and what fires we were going to be putting out. And then those officers and I would spread out over our units during the daytime and try to fight all the little fires of what happens to be going on, whether we were short parts, whether we were short MOSs or skills to take care of whatever we need to be taken care of at a time. For instance, the multi-fuel engine that were in the 2.5-ton and 5-ton trucks in Vietnam was made by Continental. And Continental, those engines were failing at about 1,000 miles. And we were having a big flap, and we had tech reps, and we tried to do studies and analysis to try to determine why the engines were failing, and this, that, and the other. So we kept that, we tried to keep things going. If anything broke down, or we had to support a different effort in the war, or the war was making a push in one particular place that affected the units in our area, we tried to make sure those units were combat ready and ready to go. So we... anything they had that was down for maintenance or down because it was broken, we gave them priority and tried to get it fixed.
Everything that you've done up to this point in your career, which is, what, about 8-10 years, was it to prepare you for what you did there, or was it completely different?
Well, for the most part, for the most part, it did prepare me for what I was doing there. You might know within the Army, we come in the Army with a particular specialty, mine happened to be missiles and munitions. And we didn't have very many missiles and munitions type officers in Vietnam at the time. We had a few, mostly munitions officers. There were a lot of those over there, and those were all ordnance officers, of course. But in the field that I was working mostly in up to that point, it was some R&D type work, and that's the type of work that I was doing, material management or research and development type projects. And but the training that I'd had in the basic course and the advanced course and at in the Command General Staff College all prepared me to do the things that I was having to do in Vietnam. But the basic ordnance skills covers ammunition and maintenance and supply, just like all the others services. Supply mostly of repair parts and stuff like that that's associated with maintenance, not quartermaster type supplies, not general supplies.
As long as you could fix problems, that was pretty much what you were there to do, and that's what...
That's right. So I was pretty well prepared, and I think my training and my background was good for what I was doing in Vietnam.
With the materials officer, was there any kind of... Do you remember any incident that sticks out as being interesting or humorous? Or?
Well... a lot of the officers that I was associated with and those that were junior to me had, I was nicknamed the Red Baron. And one was, I guess I was redheaded. But every night, I don't care what was going on, I made the rounds to the shops. And I made sure that all of our people were doing what they were supposed to be doing, even though that was really a company commander's job, not a material officer's job at the battalion level. If I found something wrong or something going on down in our shops, and I would just drive my Jeep through the shops to make sure that, because we worked, you know, many shifts or 12-hour or 16-hour shifts if we had to push things out. And so, therefore, they wrote a little song about the Red Baron rides tonight. And they played that at many little party and functions. And that was kind of cute, because the people... The people knew that I was going to show up almost every night, but they didn't know what time I was coming.
So what was the normal? Like, would you work 15, 16-hour days, 7 days a week?
Most of the time we worked from, from after breakfast at dawn to just about dusk. And then we would quit. And then I would go to dinner, and then sometime after that I would go make some checks. And Cameron Bay was a pretty secure area. So we didn't have any problems with any VCs or fighting at that particular place. So I would go to the movies sometimes. They had movies that reeled off at night. I might go once or twice a week, but either before the movie or after the movie, I'd still make my rounds to the shops and make sure that everything was going right. And on Sundays, many Sundays, we didn't work at all. We worked Saturdays, but sometimes we'd work Sundays till noon, and then we would knock off and we'd go to the beach.
You were a field grade officer at this time, correct? You were
a major. I was a major.
What was your living conditions? Did you have better living conditions than the lower enlisted and the junior officers? Or?
Oh, yes. Our living condition was very nice. When I first got there, I moved into a large wooden structure and had a little, like a cubicle with a cot. And then about 3 or 4 months after I was in Vietnam, they brought in 40-foot house traders. Normal house, two-bedroom house traders with running water. They had no sewage hookup yet, but I got one of those traders with another major in my battalion who was the XO. So the XO and I lived in it, and we had our each an individual bedroom. As a matter of fact, as a little anecdote that you might be interested in, when Bob Hope came over, we vacated the traders for part of Bob Hope's troops, and Raquel Welch occupied my trader. She occupied my trader for I think, two nights? One or two nights. It wasn't very long. But anyway, so I went back over to the barracks and stayed. As a matter of fact, the Bob Hope troop occupied about five or six of those traders over there, so they threw us all out. We changed the sheets for good old Raquel.
Now, when you took over the 63rd, wasn't it, as the commander, what did you had to move them up the coast to the DMZ. I'm assuming that was probably a logistical nightmare.
Yes, it was. I took over the 63rd Maintenance Battalion headquarters while I was in I got to think of the name of the city now, just north of Cameron Bay, and I'll think of the city in a moment. It was a... stop that for a second.
Okay.
I was assigned to the 63rd Maintenance Battalion as the commander. I moved the headquarters up to a little village just east of Fan Rang on the coast. And there we picked up some more supplies to get ready to move north. And then I was scheduled to pick up an LCU, a Navy LCU, contract LCU, was coming in to pick up the battalion headquarters and all my vehicles. And we waited for about a week or two before the Navy could get us a ship to get us up to the DMZ. We were to go ashore at a place called Wonder Beach, just south of Pontree Marine Base, and we were going to be set up our maintenance battalion at Pontree Marine Base, and then several units, one down at Camp Eagle to support the 101st Airborne Division to back up some of their maintenance units. And so anyway, I set up this headquarters, and I had to wait 2 weeks for an LCU to come in and pick us up. And finally, a Korean LCU came in to move us as far north as Da Nang. And we put in at Da Nang, took all of our equipment off, and waited on the beach at Da Nang for about another week until they could get a regular Navy LCU to move us into over Wonder Beach up at Quantry Marine Base. So actually, as a battalion commander, I spent about a month in transit before I could get up on the DMZ. At the time that we were in the Tet Offensive and the Wei Fubai War raged up at Hue, and just in north of there, the theory was at that time that the VC were going to mass some people to either overrun Quantry Marine Base or Hue or up in the north, northern portions of near the rock pile, and they thought they were going to try to put up another Dien Bien Phu. But so they started moving elements of the 5th MEC and the 101st Airborne Division north, and then they moved the 52nd Artillery Group and my battalion in to back up those divisions and to back up the 52nd Artillery Group and support-wise for combat service support. And so then we finally got that LCU out of Da Nang, and we put in over Wonder Beach and moved our vehicles in and set up at Quantry Marine Base. I went to the Marine commander at Quantry Marine Base and told him I needed some space to set up a maintenance battalion. And he told me that he didn't have any space, and if I needed some space, just push out the perimeter, set up my, and just push out and defend his perimeter. So I was probably the only maintenance battalion in Vietnam that had to defend a section of the perimeter of a Marine base. But in any case, we did it. And I had a little small engineer detachment attached to me, so they helped me put up all my wire and tangle foot. So with this attached unit, it was only like a platoon, like a 35, 40 people. So this small engineer detachment helped us out. But anyway, I was assigned to be the commander, and I had a material section, just like I used to be the material officer for the other battalion. And we set up and we got trucking, but as I had units spread all over, and it was about a month later before some of the second and third units came in. The 596 Light Maintenance Company came in over the beach, actually from the States. And the first night they came ashore, they were setting up in our area, and we took some rockets and lost. We took five or six casualties, one dead. And the first night, those poor guys pushed ashore because they hadn't even finished digging in yet. So, but at any rate, we were there to support, and we continued to support the best we can, even though we got rocketed. It certainly was a difference between Cameron Bay and what I went to at Quantry Marine Base, but we managed.
Now, you mentioned the Tet Offensive briefly. Was that the first time you'd experienced combat, and what exactly happened, and how did that come about?
Well, of course, the Tet Offensive, occurs in early February each year. I think it's a different date, but I think it was around the first week in February in 1968, and that's when the VC openly marched into most of the major cities of Vietnam, like they were getting ready to take over the place. It was kind of brazen, really. At the time that it started, I was in that little village in just north of Cameron Bay, getting ready to catch that LCU to go up to Da Nang. And the VC came into that village with a marching like they were on a parade. And they took a lot of casualties, though, but they also blew up one of our NCO clubs, and we took some casualties also in that same little action. But basically, the biggest action that it involved in that was when I was trying to move. The reason I had to stay in Da Nang so long was that I couldn't go through the Hai Van Pass with my unit to get on into Quang Tri Marine Base because Wei Phu Bai, the city of Wei, was just about leveled from the large VC contingent that went in, and we went in after them, and all the bridges and the citadel and those things up at Wei had burned, and it was a nasty affair, and all roads were mined. And when I finally got fed up and said I had to get my battalion in set up, the day I left the edge of the battle area up there headed for, after we came across the beach to get on into where I had to get to at Quang Tri Marine Base, I started leading my troops and my trucks and my headquarters portion, which is a small, you know, about 120, 30 people, and 15, 20 trucks, out of Wei Phu Bai area. And we came across minesweepers, and they said the road hadn't been cleared ahead. I said, hey, I don't have time. So we just passed them up and just kept going. But we had sandbags in the floorboards, and we didn't run across any mines. So we got on in without an incident. So, and we finally got set up, and I was anxious to get the troops to work, because when the troops were sitting around like was at Da Nang and sitting around in that little village down by Cameron Bay, when the troops are idle, they're not very happy.
Now, the troops that you had, I'm assuming a lot of them were the draftees, the people who weren't happy about being there in the first place. How was the morale, and how was the discipline and that kind of issue in the battalion?
Well, I said earlier before you started recording that I think we had a higher educated troop. We had more technicians. There were a lot of draftees, but they were mechanics and cooks and bakers, and not candlestick makers, but they're radio repairmen. And we had the morale, I think, this was very, very high. The troops always drank beer late at night and sang those songs like, I want to get out of this place if it's the last thing I ever do. So it's a very popular song when I was in Vietnam. But the fact is, they worked very, very hard. They applied themselves very, very hard. And we had very few incidents that involved somebody saying, I'm not going to fight in this war. It's a bad war. I never had an incident like that at all. Yeah, not one. And the people I associated with were there because their country sent them there. And they wanted to come over, and as far as I'm concerned, they wanted to do a good job, and they wanted to stay alive, and they wanted to go home when their tour was up. And I think they really wanted to go home. And so we did everything we could to keep them alive and let them go home. So,
well, as the battalion commander, you were the main disciplinarian, in essence, for the Article 15s in the court.
I had a few incidents that I wish hadn't happened. I had a kid that traded a bottle of wild turkey or something for a 45 caliber grease gun. At the time, I don't know if you know what a grease gun is. I've forgotten the designation of it. We don't even use it. We weren't even using it in the Army at the time, and I'm not sure where it even came from. But it was a little machine gun that's sort of almost like an Uzi of today, but it had a little round chamber on it. And it cost about $20 to make it, and half that was the barrel. So, but at any rate, he traded it to some Marine for a bottle of booze. And when he was cleaning the weapon that night, it's a rollback-operated weapon, and when he was cleaning the weapon, it discharged several times, and it killed the kid in the next bunk. And, of course, that was a little bit of a problem when you have to accompany the commander trying to write to somebody's wife or mother to tell them that their son had died as a result of an accident like that. But things like that are tough. We had a lot more marijuana incidents after my men were up in the Quantrill Marine Base area up in the DMZ, up near the DMZ, with marijuana. Never got any hard drugs, hardline drugs, not in 67, but we had a lot of pot and pot smoking at that time. And I had a few cases as a battalion commander come to me for punishment for possession, smoking marijuana, smoking pot, and the same other. And these people were disciplined. A lot of them got company punishment, but if they were second or third offender, then they came up to me for either a special or no general court-martials, but special court-martial.
Most of that was handled at the company level, but I'm sure you still had to be aware of what was going on down at that level.
Oh, yes. All the papers had to come up through me when they were forwarded for that type of punishment. So,
why would you think that there was more marijuana once you moved up north? Is it because of close to the fighting, or is it just more available?
I think Cameron Bay was like a very urbanized area. I'm not sure why I didn't get entangled up with much marijuana. At the time, as a materiel officer, I had very little duties associated with the troops. The commanders were policing the troops as far as discipline was concerned, and I was more involved in the operations and what was going on support-wise. And therefore, I wasn't deeply involved. I did have to do for a group an Article 32 investigation on a lieutenant that was stealing cameras and film and stuff and packing it up and sending it home. And he was caught. I did an Article 32 investigation, and I recommended that this kid be allowed to resign his commission and go home instead of being court-martialed for general court-martial. But this poor kid is just a mixed-up little lieutenant. But at any rate, I had more opportunities as a commander to get involved with discipline as a battalion commander than I did, certainly than as I did as a material officer. So therefore, it was probably there, but I just wasn't cognizant of it because I didn't get involved in any of it. And I didn't see any of it at night or any place like that. And none of the officers that I associated with was involved in anything like that when I was in Vietnam.
So it was mainly lower enlisted, D4 and below, probably.
Very, yes. I have walked into GP medium tents where troops were sleeping and things like that, and I could, you know, you could smell it in a heartbeat, and so I knew it was there. And I would leave, and I would call it to the attention of a first sergeant or a platoon sergeant. I said, "There's somebody's in there smoking pot. We need to find out who it is." And so I turned it over to the company commanders and some of their NCOs to take care of it.
How widespread do you think the problem was? Was it, you know, about 10 people out of the battalion or half the battalion?
Oh, I think it was very slight. If I was guessing, I would say way less than 10%, probably 5%.
So it wasn't something that consumed your time?
No, it was nothing. No, it sure wasn't. It was just a every once in a while thing, as a matter of fact.
Now, you mentioned some casualties you've taken some at once you got to the Marine base, and you some when you were at the village near Cameron Bay. How many casualties did your unit take during the time you were the commander?
When I was a commander, I had 1,400 troops, and I took, in the 5 months or so that I was in with the unit, not counting the 30 days or so it took us to get us into the position. Four and a half or 5 months, I took 96 casualties, and only one death, though. We were rocketed almost nightly up in Quantry area. Rocket attacks. We took rocket attacks over Wonder, coming in on Wonder Beach. We got rocketed. So most of that was rocket attacks. I was driving between my battalion headquarters and Camp Eagle, which was like 45 miles, and my driver and I was we were fired upon by a small arms fire out of a cemetery of all places. But so a couple of VC or somebody was in there hiding behind some tombstones or something. But anyway, we just kept going.
Did your portion of the perimeter ever get attacked and probed, or was it just mainly rocket?
We had we put out every night. We put out listening. When I first pushed this out, I sent some of my NCOs out to obtain some equipment that we didn't have, night vision scopes, and some things that we didn't have that I thought we needed. We also needed some special sound power phones so I could put out listening posts. I put out listening posts every night about 100-150 yards in front of my line, so if somebody's coming in, I might hear them and have them hide out there. And even if somebody passed them coming in, they were to just lay low and be quiet, but let us know.
So combat service support became combat pretty quickly.
Yes. We had perimeter, and we put up some tangle foot and some wire with that little engineer detachment that was attached to me. And we put up claymore mines. And one night, I was at the CP. They said that they saw some movement to their front, but we had no reports from the listening post. And a guy came in and said, on my starlight scope, I see somebody walking across our front. It looks like they have an ammunition box on their head. And that sometimes they carry things up on top of their head and just balance them like Africans do, but if they were heavy. And so I said, well, pick... I told the operator, one of the officers that was on duty up at the command post at that hour of the night, I just happened to be there talking to him. I said, tell him to pick out one guy and try to pick this guy off. And we fired one shot, and we forgot to tell everybody else on our front that we were about to fire one shot. And my whole section opened up with, we probably fired 10,000 rounds and never hit anything. But anyway, what we did was we shot up our wire and a whole bunch of stuff. And I think we even fired one claymore. We had to go out and repair all of our lines the next morning. But we never did get really attacked through our particular section. As a matter of fact, things started tailing off like that. There was a large ammunition storage area about 6 miles away, and I had a couple of troops, three or four troops up there working during the daytime, and we were repairing cranes and rough terrain forklifts that were being used to move ammunition around, because we moved a lot of ammunition around. And it was rocketed during the daytime, and they caught a hold of this ammunition dump, and it blew sky high, and you could see it for miles and miles around, and it wiped out all my rough terrain forklifts and cranes that I had up there. So, but we didn't get anybody injured in that little action, but we were fortunate.
You're probably the best person to answer a question like this. The equipment that you had and the equipment that you repaired, I know you mentioned the engines on the 5 tons of Nusahat were less about 1,000 miles. How would you say overall the equipment that the U.S. Army put out in the Vietnam War was and stand up to it? Was it good enough for the effort or not?
Well, I would say it was about average. It's probably not as good as it was today. The equipment that we had in Vietnam, my opinion, in many cases was not well suited to fight that type of war, in that we were driving 5 tons and deuce and a half over roads that would just shake them to pieces, ruts as deep as a man almost. And we had to put braces on the fenders because the fenders shook till they fell off. The dust and environment of the travel for these five, even the dump trucks that were in the engine every time that we were repairing that used these Continental multi-fuel engines. A multi-fuel engine being either gasoline or diesel, you could feed either one through it. And it was a fuel injected. So the M113 armored personnel carrier of that day was mostly of aluminum. And if anything hit it, a satchel charge on the roof of it would just blow the roof right out the bottom. And if there's anybody in there with it, it just crushed them. And while I was up on the DMC, a unit from the 7th Cavalry circled their little wagons one night, their PCs. There was about a company down there, and they got attacked by an RSVC force. And I could see all the illumination rounds and thus trying to light these people up so they could see the VC. But the VC put satchel charges up on top of these PCs, and it just tore them apart because I went out and placed them all up. The next day or two, my units went out and picked them up, and I went out and looked at some of these PCs. So some of that equipment was not as well suited as like the vehicles we have today, the Bradley or the Abrams tank, the M1 tank. It didn't hold up as well, and those 113s were gasoline driven, and I mean when you get hit with a gasoline tank, it blows up big time. So. So some of that equipment was not, the weapons that we had, the artillery weapons, the small arms stuff was as good or superior to what the enemy had as far as weapons were concerned.
You didn't have any problems with the 16, that the first versions of it?
No, the 16 or the AR-15 or whatever they called that thing, I forgot. That's right, the AR-15, which later became the M16 after they modified a little bit. It was a pretty fine weapon. I didn't like it. I didn't carry one of it. As a matter of fact, when I got up on Quantry Marine Base, all I had was a .45 caliber pistol. And as a commander, I said, I'm never going to shoot this. So I cleaned it real good. I carried a shoulder holster. I wrapped it up in plastic, and I had the troops go steal me an M2 carbine. And that's what I carried. And that's because I was going to shoot them a long way off. I'm not shooting them with a .45 that close.
So, troops acquire you at any
point. Right. Yeah. I had the troops acquire me when I...
And your sergeant major was there to protect you, of course.
Yes, the sergeant major, he was a good guy. I sent the supply sergeant in one day to we put up this, we dug out a command center. We dug it out with a bulldozer from this detachment and put it on our little command center underground. We ran our lines out to our listening post from there, But I told him, I said, we really need some ice. So I had the supply sergeant deal with the Marines to get an ice machine and a 5K, a 10 kW generator. So when he went out to acquire all this other stuff, he got me an M2 carbine while he was over there negotiating. So
not only down south, but up north, you had all the comforts of home as well.
That's right, all the comforts of home. And we had to get two mortars. Nobody in our unit knew how to use a mortar, but that night that I thought I had somebody walking on my perimeter out there that was a VC, I called for some illumination from the support from the Marines, and they told me that they had to go to Corps to get permission to fire a mission like that. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. I said, I got somebody out there walking. And anyway, I had my troops go get some 60mm mortars, but I forbid them to get any HE ammunition. I just got illumination rounds. And whenever we had a problem in our front, we just fired our own illumination, just little 60mm illumination rounds.
So as a commander, you're able to adapt to your surroundings and what equipment you didn't have, you acquired.
Yes, what equipment I didn't have, I acquired.
What did you think about the enemy soldiers that you encountered? I know you probably didn't come up close and personal, but...
The only enemy soldiers I encountered were either wounded or dead. as far as me being as close to me to you. I saw some in the distance a couple of times, and those I saw some run from that graveyard I talked about earlier when they took off. They fired a couple of rounds at my Jeep, missed the Jeep. One of them went through the windshield, but they took off running just as soon as they fired, because I guess they thought we were going to fire back at them or something. Anyway, I never really got close to them. To the VC, you know, I could see a lot of tracer rounds coming from their weapons, but they were a long way off.
How would you evaluate their ability to fight? You weren't enough encounters with them.
Well, I think they had a lot more capability to fight than we ever gave them credit for. The supplies and equipment coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They may bring down a rocket launcher and 50 guys carrying 6 rounds apiece coming down 50 yards apart all night long down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They got the job done. And it might have taken them a lot longer. It was a lot labor intensive, but they got the job done and they got the equipment that they needed. And they fought a guerrilla type war and they did it well, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, what did you think when you were... in Cameron Bay, and they said, okay, go up to the DMZ. What was your initial reaction as to what you were going to encounter, the enemy?
Well, first of all, I was kind of honored for being selected as a battalion commander, as a major, because all battalion commanders are lieutenant colonel. So, but at any rate, I did sit down and say, well, this could be it, because I was going to a place where the fighting was going to be hot and heavy, and that's when I mentioned that Kaysan was a little Marine Corps held thing that they thought was going to be a Dien Bien Phu that was over at the end of Route 9, just south of the DMZ, which is that area where they put those people in there. So I knew that I was going from an urbanized area that was almost like living in Sun Lakes, Arizona, almost. To an area where there could be a lot more fighting, and it turned out to be that was true. Getting rocketed almost every night means that you had to sleep inside a sandbag enclosure most of the time. But anyway, I think most of the troops in the battalion headquarters had sort of the same feelings, that they were a little bit concerned and nervous about going in. But we managed to calm them down. And I think the experiences of taking in a battalion headquarters before some of the units, the companies arrived, was good. And the fact that we got, as soon as we came ashore, we said, you guys dig and dig fast and get under the best you can. And it's really tough to maintain vehicles and artillery pieces and weapons and radios when the old gong could go off any time for a rocket attack and you have to jump under something. A day or night. The worst I've ever had was when I got I was in the outhouse doing my daily functions when I got a rocket around. It came just a few feet from my this outhouse, and it took the screen wire out of the top part. And I'm sitting there trying to get my pants up. But at any rate, it was different. I knew it was going to be different, and I was nervous about it, but I think what we did was we said, well, this is what we got to do. We got to do it, and we got to do a good job and get up there. The problems were, the biggest problem I had was the delay of getting up there. I had troops that were anxious about it, and that just gives you 2 weeks of sitting at Da Nang on the beach worried about where you're going to go. I guess in some respect we're saying, hey, we've been delayed, so we don't have to do this, but at the same time, it gives you more time to think about it.
Well, with that, did you tell your wife, that you had a wife and kids at home, did you tell them you were going to a more hostile area? How was the whole...
Yes, I told them it was going to be a little bit more dangerous and in my letters. And, of course, at that particular time, though, by the way, I had just met Judy in Hawaii for R&R, and I spent in between my Cameron Bay tour and about in early January... right after New Year's or so, I met Judy in Hawaii, and we spent a nice week in Hawaii. And at that time, I knew where I was going. So a lot of that I did face-to-face, and I told her that it was going to be a lot different, and that there may be some times when I couldn't. I wrote her every day, every night, sometime. I said, there may be a day or two when you won't hear from me, but I don't think that ever happened. I think that I was busy even when we were rocketed. I got a letter off, but the letters might have... She said she would go along and get no letters for 3 or 4 days, and then she'd get 5 at once. So that's just the way the mail worked. It was a lot worse after Cameron Bay up on the DMZ because the APOs didn't work as well or as efficient in combat zones as they did in big cities.
So you were a career military officer, and I'm sure your wife was almost used to the fact that you were sometimes going to be gone for extended periods of time.
Yeah, well, and plus we had, she went to Tulsa, Oklahoma to her grandmother's house. And it was really nice of her grandmother to take her and three small boys, because they were like, the oldest was only like first grader, 6, and they went down 6, you know, 4 and 3 or so, so they were pretty young. But her time was also occupied. That was sort of good, taking care of those three boys and taking care of her grandmother and trying to make sure the three boys didn't drive her grandmother crazy was good. So that occupied her time. But, of course, they're always watching the news, and the news about the Vietnam War was, at that particular time, was not always good because that was right after Tet Offensive, and we were taking quite a few casualties at that particular time in Vietnam in 67-68. It was pretty bad. So,
what was the... were you able to judge or gauge the American reaction in Vietnam about Vietnam?
Only through the... what do they call it? The Yellow Bird. it was the handout version of the Stars and Stripes that circulated around Vietnam. The newspaper with whatever news you were getting off the wires, like UPI, API, and those types of things. And the maintenance battalion, even as a commander in Vietnam, we didn't get much intelligence information. So a lot of the information we got on how the war was going, we got out of newspapers. So off the Yellow Bird, or I forgot what we call that little newspaper, that little scandal sheet. But it was okay. It gave some news from home, and the guys liked to read that article on paper. Some sports scores of what was going on. There was very little in there about... all the controversy and the people going to Canada to avoid the draft and blah, blah, and so on. But there was some of that information in there, but not much.
Did Judy mention much of that in her letters, or was it mainly just kids did this?
No, I don't know. I don't think Tulsa, Oklahoma was a big center of activities as far as anti-Vietnam demonstrations went. And it certainly wasn't like Washington, D.C. or someplace, or L.A. or... someplace like that that was very big in that type of thing. Tulsa, Oklahoma is kind of like a quiet oil town.
Is there anything that you haven't mentioned that sticks out in your mind about the year you spent in Vietnam?
Well, I think there's some things that I did over there that I probably shouldn't have done, and if I had to do over, I'd probably do a little bit different as a commander. And I might have not had as many casualties or something, but I'm not sure what I could have done at the time. You always wonder whether you did enough or whether the job you did was enough to take care of your people or to make sure you were doing what you were sent there to do. And there's nothing you can do to avoid casualties if there's rockets falling around sort of randomly all over the place, because if they're going to hit you, half the time it was just... guy happened to be standing at the wrong place at the wrong time when a rocket hit, that's all. And nothing you can do about that. But every once in a while I think of something, I say, well, we should have tried that. And that might be something that would be tried today, but we didn't even know about it then. So you always have second thoughts and second guesses of what's going on. But basically, I don't think that there's anything I can think of that I would really change much about doing it. And I don't think I really had a hard time in Vietnam, as hard as many people had. I mean, certainly spending 6 months in Cam Ranh Bay was like going to the beach. But we spent our Sunday afternoons at the beach. And but that the last 4 months or so up on the, I was glad to leave. And as a matter of fact, 2 days before I was supposed to leave Vietnam, I went down to the Marines and got on a C-130 and went to Cam Ranh Bay and spent 2 nights with my old unit and all the guys just before I shipped out home. And I left from Cam Ranh Bay Airport, the air base at Cam Ranh Bay. They had contract flights flying people in and out.
As you were leaving, what did you think? How did you feel like what you accomplished or the reason the U.S. was there? What was your feelings about the whole experience?
Well, at that point in time, I knew that I was there for a very unpopular war, and I was going home and could take some grief from people because I had read enough, a few of the articles that about the demonstrations and what was going on. And but most of the real demonstrations and things that came along from the McNamara era came along after I got home. And a lot of that started up after I got home. So it even got worse after I got home for the next 2 or 3 years. Though, when I arrived back home, though, I was greeted greatly by the neighbors and everybody in town. Big signs up, welcome home. Welcome home, Daddy, from the kids across the whole front yard and stuff. It was kind of neat.
Was that in Tulsa or was that?
That was in Tulsa when I, but I flew into to Seattle, Tacoma, and the next day I got put on leave and I flew to, I met Judy in Oklahoma City and spent 2 days in Oklahoma City just with Judy before we went to Tulsa where the kids were with the grandmother. And so I had a couple days with her in Oklahoma City. As a matter of fact, I had her aunt and uncle lived in Oklahoma City, and they gave us her house, and they brought us a dinner in a revolving restaurant, a nice restaurant in downtown Oklahoma City. So it was kind of nice. And then we drove on over to Tulsa to the kids. And when I got there, the neighbors and the big signs were out across the whole front of the house, like "Welcome home, Daddy," and blah blah and so on. So I was greeted very well in there. So I never personally got involved, not one time, in any incident where somebody said, "Why did you go to Vietnam, you killer, murderer of children and women, and that illegal war? Why did you fight?" Blah blah. I never. Never once.
Well, you went to, you stayed in the military for 15 years after that, so you pretty much went from post to post after that, so you were surrounded by other people who were in the same incidents as you.
Yes, that's true.
Now, as a whole, how do you think, or how do you feel about the U.S. involvement in Vietnam? Was it necessary? Was it good?
I guess after the fact, I would say no. We probably even shouldn't have been there. But we were sent there, and we were sent there in good faith by our country, and we went over there and did the best job we could. And but I think the political arena of the time made the wrong decision to put us into Vietnam. That was a little bit quick. I don't think that if that all happened again today, I don't think we would go in to a Vietnam conflict. I know we just went into an Iraq in Kuwait, but I think that was a little bit, the circumstances were a little bit different, and our national interests were a little bit different. I'm not sure our national resolve and national interests were on our side in the Vietnam War. I don't think that our national interests, whether Vietnam was communist or non-communist, I don't think we had any national interests at all in Vietnam. And so why did we go in there? I mean, we had advisors there for years, but then we built up to half a million troops over the next 3, 4, 5 years. That's I don't think any of our national interests were at stake in Vietnam at all.
Well, and just real quickly on something, the military leaders, and not the political leaders in Washington, but the military leaders. How do you think they conducted the war? Did they do it the proper way? Was it things they could have done differently? I know you can't second guess everybody, but
I think our military leaders did the very best they could under the circumstances, and I think they were reined in by the political powers that be at the time. There is absolutely no way to fight a guerrilla type warfare without actually doing something like we did in the Iraq War. You got to just charge off and take his country over. You might hand it back to him right after you cut across it, but you can't, unless we invaded North Vietnam and took it over and stopped all that stuff. You can't do it by bombing North Vietnam and bombing the jungles and defoliating the jungles. People could hide in those jungles in Vietnam forever. You'd never get them out. So.
What did you take away from your year in Vietnam? Do you think it helped your career or helped you personally, or did it help you at all?
Well, my wife says I'm the only Army officer that she knows of that went to Vietnam and gained weight. When I was at Camp Ron Bay, we ate well, even though we took that morning pill every day for malaria, and we spent a lot of time in the John thereafter. We ate well, and I think my experience in Vietnam made me a better person, and also it helped me understand a little bit about more about what my the involvement of my own military career and the progression that I was going to take in the military. I think it was personally good for me. It was certainly good for my career, because I would never have made 06 if I hadn't been into Vietnam, in the Vietnam War. And I think some of those things about doing a good job at Cam Ranh Bay, so that the powers that be in Vietnam selected me to be a battalion commander, to me said that I was doing a good enough job while there, because that had nothing to do with my personnel records and things that was going on back in the States, because that didn't even count as far as being selected as battalion commander, getting your old ticket punched, as we called it, as far as your career goes. That was done locally in Vietnam by local area commanders, and later on reported up the channel as to what your assignments actually were. I'm in the driveway with my golf cart. I think it made me a better person because, A, I became more worldly. I knew what was going on in Vietnam, though I didn't get a lot of intelligence about what was happening, but I knew that when we started bombing the North, I knew how the war was going in general, as much as a maintenance battalion commander ought to know. I certainly got enough intelligence to do my particular job, which is on a need-to-know type basis of what was going on in the war. And I became a lot more knowledgeable when I was selected to be a battalion commander and went up north, where there was a lot of fighting raging in the upper north, and there was a lot down in the Delta regions of Vietnam at the time that I was there. But the heaviest fighting was going on up in the north and then going west over towards Anshan Valley from Quezon. So.
And looking back, if you look at like Jane Fonda, or when President Carter pardoned all the people who dodged the draft, how do you feel about the demonstrators and the people who did things that were in contrast to what you had to do?
I guess I look upon this a little bit different than most people. I guess I would fight for their right to do whatever they thought they needed to do to state their opinions. I would defend them, their right to do that to the end. I really would. But I also think that what I was doing was right. I was sent over there by my country, and that's what, I was in the Army. I was a career military person. They called upon me to go over there and do a job. I went over there and do my job. Now, I don't particularly like it because I don't think Jane Fonda is a very good patriot, and it certainly didn't bid well for our country. But I would stand up for her right to speak out and say what's on her mind. I think that's a First Amendment, and if we want to criticize our president or whatever we want to do, I think we ought to be able to do that. And now there are better ways sometimes to do that through the courts or through the laws, and get our laws amended in our country, or get better representatives, or vote for a different person. And that doesn't seem to be fast enough for some people, so therefore they go downtown and demonstrate. But I guess everybody has an opinion, and though I don't like it, I think I like to hear them. And if somebody has an opinion I don't like, I say, hey, I think you're wrong. But you know, you're entitled to your opinion. That's the way I look at it. I look at the world that way. I don't, when somebody has an opinion different from mine, I don't hate them for it. So therefore, I don't hate Jane Fonda. I certainly don't respect her opinion. And I think it's a bad thing that what she did as far as turning people against. We don't have any flag wavers anymore. We don't have any patriots anymore. And that's a bad thing. That's a bad thing. And to overcome something like that's hard. If you have too many Jane Fondas, it's difficult.
That's all I have. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
Well, I hope I gave you enough information to write something down. I don't know if I did or not. If you're looking for blood and guts stories, I don't have any of those. But I'm not sure what you're doing in your paper, but I tried to tell you everything I tried to tell you.
This is Gary Hayes, and I'm interviewing L.W. Clement at Dr. Badger's house at 11005 East Chestnut in Sun Lakes, Arizona, on June 3rd, 2000 at 1:30 p.m. Mr. Clement, can you please excuse me, state your years of service and the rank that you retired as?
Okay, I entered the service in November of 1957, and I retired in 1982 with 26 years of service. I retired as a Colonel 06.
And what was your branch?
Ordnance Corps.
Okay. And you went to Vietnam at what time in your career?
I went to, from the Command and General Staff College, I entered the, I went to Vietnam in June of 1967, and I returned in June of 1968.
Okay, and what unit were you in the first time?
Well, the first unit I joined in Vietnam was the 69th Maintenance Battalion, when I was the materiel officer for the battalion. And then I, the second 6 months, about December, I was selected to be the commander of the 63rd Maintenance Battalion to take the battalion up on the DMZ about 11 miles to Quantry Marine Base. And that's where I assembled the battalion. I had five companies, like 1,450 men or so, and there to support the northern First Corps region of Vietnam.
The first 6 months, you were the materiels officer. What is the function of a materiel? What do you do?
Well, in a maintenance battalion, we support all the various commodities, automotive, tank automotive, electronics, and there is a materiel section that has commodity-oriented officers in each one of those areas, and it's basically how the battalion operates day-to-day, all the day-to-day operations of the battalion. Those units involved in maintenance of tanks and automotive and artillery and electronics components, refrigeration, whatever it takes. And these commodities, there are like six officers in each, in a materiel section, and each one of them support various commodities. And I was just the overseer of the all the battalion operations in the various maintenance areas.
So you were combat service support.
Yes, right, combat service support.
And what would be a daily life, what was a day in life like for you? What was a normal mission?
Well, every day, and first thing in the morning, I met with the most of the six officers came into my office, and we had a cup of coffee, and we'd outlined what we were going to be doing that day and what they were going to be doing that day and where our problems were in our particular region of Cameron Bay and what we were going to be supporting and what fires we were going to be putting out. And then those officers and I would spread out over our units during the daytime and try to fight all the little fires of what happens to be going on, whether we were short parts, whether we were short MOSs or skills to take care of whatever we need to be taken care of at the time. For instance, the multi-fuel engine that were in the 2.5-ton and 5-ton trucks in Vietnam was made by Continental. And Continental, those engines were failing at about 1,000 miles. And we were having a big flap, and we had tech reps, and we tried to do studies and analysis to try to determine why the engines were failing, and this, that, and the other. So we kept that, we tried to keep things going. If anything broke down, or we had to support a different effort in the war, or the war was making a push in one particular place that affected the units in our area, we tried to make sure those units were combat ready and ready to go. So anything they had that was down for maintenance or down because it was broken, we gave them priority in trying to get it fixed.
Everything that you've done up to this point in your career, which is, about 8-10 years, was it to prepare you for what you did there, or was it completely different?
Well, for the most part, it did prepare me for what I was doing there. You might know within the Army, we come in the Army with a particular specialty. Mine happened to be missiles and munitions. And we didn't have very many missiles and munitions type officers in Vietnam at the time. We had a few, mostly munitions officers. There were a lot of those over there. And those were all ordnance officers, of course. But in the field that I was working mostly in up to that point, it was some R&D type work. And that's the type of work that I was doing. Material management or research and development type projects. And but the training that I'd had in the basic course and the advanced course and that in the Command General Staff College all prepared me to do the things that I was having to do in Vietnam. With the basic ordnance skills, covers ammunition and maintenance and supply, just like all the others services. Supply mostly of repair parts and stuff like that that's associated with maintenance, not quartermaster type supplies, not general supplies.
As long as you could fix problems, that was pretty much what you were there to do, and that's what.
That's right. So I was pretty well prepared, and I think my training and my background was good for what I was doing in Vietnam.
With the materials officer, was there any kind of, do you remember any incident that sticks out as being interesting or humorous or?
Well, a lot of the officers that I was associated with and those that were junior to me had, I was nicknamed the Red Baron. And one was, I guess I was redheaded. But every night, I don't care what was going on, I made the rounds to the shops and I made sure that all of our people were doing what they were supposed to be doing, even though that was really a company commander's job, not a material officer's job at the battalion level. If I found something wrong or something going on down in our shops, and I would just drive my Jeep through the shops to make sure that, because we worked, you know, many shifts or 12-hour or 16-hour shifts if we had to push things out. And so, therefore, they wrote a little song about the Red Baron rides tonight. And they played that at many little party and functions. And that was kind of cute. But the people knew that I was going to show up almost every night, but they didn't know what time I was coming.
So what was the normal, like, would you work 15, 16-hour days, 7 days a week?
Most of the time we worked from after breakfast at dawn to just about dusk. And then we would quit. And then I would go to dinner, and then sometime after that I would go make some checks. In Cameron Bay was was a pretty secure area. So we didn't have any problems with any VCs or fighting at that particular place. So I would go to the movies sometimes. They had movies that reeled off at night. I might go once or twice a week. But either before the movie or after the movie, I'd still make my rounds to the shops to make sure that everything was going right. And on Sundays, many Sundays, we didn't work at all. We worked Saturdays, but sometimes we'd work Sundays till noon. And then we would knock off and we'd go to the beach.
You were a field grade officer at this time, correct? You were
a major. I was a major.
What was your living conditions? Did you have better living conditions than the lower enlisted and the junior officers? Or?
Oh, yes. Our living condition was very nice. When I first got there, I moved into a large wooden structure and had a little like a cubicle with a cot. And then about 3 or 4 months after I was in Vietnam, they brought in 40-foot house traders. Normal house, two-bedroom house traders with running water. They had no sewage hookup yet, but I got one of those traders with another major in my battalion who was the XO. So the XO and I lived in that, and we had our each an individual bedroom. As a matter of fact, as a little anecdote that you might be interested in, when Bob Hope came over, we vacated the traders for part of Bob Hope's troops, and Raquel Welch occupied my trader. She occupied my trader for I think, 2 nights. One or two nights. It wasn't very long. But anyway, so I went back over to the barracks and stayed. So, as a matter of fact, the Bob Hope troop occupied about 5 or 6 of those traders over there, so they threw us all out. We changed the sheets for good old Raquel.
Now, when you took over the 63rd, wasn't it, as the commander, what did you had to move them up the coast to the DMZ. I'm assuming that was probably a logistical nightmare.
Yes, it was. I took over the 63rd Maintenance Battalion headquarters while I was I got to think of the name of the city now. Just north of Cameron Bay, and I'll think of the city in a moment. It was a... stop that for a second.
Okay.
I was assigned to the 63rd Maintenance Battalion as the commander. I moved the headquarters up to a little village just east of Phan Rang on the coast. And there we picked up some more supplies to get ready to move north. And then I was scheduled to pick up an LCU, a Navy LCU, contract LCU, was coming in to pick up the battalion headquarters and all my vehicles. And we waited for about a week or two before the Navy could get us a ship to get us up to the DMZ. We were to go ashore at a place called Wonder Beach, just south of Quantry Marine Base. And we were going to be set up our maintenance battalion at Quantry Marine Base, and then several units, one down at Camp Eagle to support the 101st Airborne Division to back up some of their maintenance units. And so anyway, I set up this headquarters, and I had to wait 2 weeks for an LCU could come in and pick us up. And finally, a Korean LCU came in to move us as far north as Da Nang. And we put in at Da Nang, took all of our equipment off, and waited on the beach at Da Nang for about another week until they could get a regular Navy LCU to move us into over Wonder Beach up at Quantry Marine Base. So actually, as a battalion commander, I spent about a month in transit before I could get up on the DMZ. At the time that we were in the Tet Offensive and the Wei Fubai War raged up at Hue, and just in north of there, the theory was at that time that the VC were going to mass some people to either overrun Quantry Marine Base or Hue or up in the north, northern portions of near the rock pile, and they thought they were going to try to put up another Dien Bien Phu. But so they started moving elements of the 5th MEC and the 101st Airborne Division north And then they moved the 52nd Artillery Group and my battalion in to back up those divisions and to back up the 52nd Artillery Group in support-wise for combat service support. And so then we finally got that LCU out of Da Nang, and we put in over Wonder Beach and moved our vehicles in and set up at Quang Tri Marine Base. I went to the Marine commander at Quang Tri Marine Base and told him I needed some space to set up a maintenance battalion. And he told me that he didn't have any space, and if I needed some space, just push out to a perimeter, set up and just push out and defend his perimeter. So I was probably the only maintenance battalion in Vietnam that had to defend a section of the perimeter of a Marine base. But in any case, we did it. And I had a little small engineer detachment attached to me, so they helped me put up all my wire and tangle foot. So with this attached unit, it was only like a platoon, like a 35, 40 people. So this small engineer detachment helped us out. But anyway, I was assigned to be the commander, and I had a material section, just like I used to be the material officer for the other battalion. And we set up and we got trucking, but then I had units spread all over, and it was about a month later before some of the second and third units came in. The 596 Light Maintenance Company came in over the beach, actually from the States. And the first night they came ashore, they were setting up in our area, and we took some rockets and lost. We took five or six casualties, one dead. And the first night, those poor guys pushed ashore because they hadn't even finished digging in yet. So, but at any rate, we were there to support, and we continued to support the best we can, even though we got rocketed. It certainly was a difference between Cam Ranh Bay and what I went to at Quang Tri Marine Base, but we managed.
Now, you mentioned the Tet Offensive briefly. Was that the first time you'd experienced combat, and what exactly happened, and how did that come about?
Well, of course, the Tet Offensive, Tet occurs in early February each year. I think it's a different date, but I think it was around the first week in February in 1968, and that's when the VC openly marched into most of the major cities of Vietnam, like they were getting ready to take over the place. It was kind of brazen, really. At the time that it started, I was in that little village in just north of Cam Ranh Bay, getting ready to catch that LCU to go up to Da Nang. And the VC came into that village with a marching like they were on a parade. And they took a lot of casualties, though, but they also blew up one of our NCO clubs, and we took some casualties also in that same little action. But basically, the biggest action that it involved in that was when I was trying to move. The reason I had to stay in Da Nang so long was that I couldn't go through the Hai Van Pass with my unit to get on into Quang Tri Marine Base because Wei Phu Bai, the city of Wei, was just about leveled from the large VC contingent that went in, and we went in after them, and all the bridges and the citadel and those things up at Wei had burned, and it was a nasty affair, and all roads were mined. And when I finally got fed up and said I had to get my battalion in set up, the day I left the edge of the battle area up there headed for, after we came across the beach to get on into where I had to get to at Quang Tri Marine Base, I started leading my troops and my trucks and my headquarters portion, which is a small, about 120, 30 people, and 15, 20 trucks, out of Wei Phu Bai area. And we came across minesweepers, and they said the road hadn't been cleared ahead. I said, hey, I don't have time. So we just passed them up and just kept going. But we had sandbags in the floorboards, and we didn't run across any mines. So we got on in without an incident. So, and we finally got set up, and I was anxious to get the troops to work, because when the troops were sitting around like was at Da Nang and sitting around in that little village down by Cam Ranh Bay, when the troops are idle, they're not very happy.
Now, the troops that you had, I'm assuming a lot of them were the draftees, the people who weren't happy about being there in the first place. How was the morale and how was the discipline and that kind of issue in the battalion?
Well, I said earlier before you started recording that I think we had a higher educated troop. We had more technicians. There were a lot of draftees, but they were mechanics and cooks and bakers and not candlestick makers, but they're radio repairmen. And we had the morale, I think, was very, very high. The troops always drank beer late at night and sang those songs like, "I want to get out of this place if it's the last thing I ever do." So it's a very popular song when I was in Vietnam. But the fact is, they worked very, very hard. They applied themselves very, very hard. And we had very few incidents that involved somebody saying, "I'm not going to fight in this war. It's a bad war." I never had an incident like that at all. Not one. And the people I associated with were there because their country sent them there. And they wanted to come over, and as far as I'm concerned, they wanted to do a good job, and they wanted to stay alive, and they wanted to go home when their tour was up. And I think they really wanted to go home. And so we did everything we could to keep them alive, and let them go home. So,
well, as the battalion commander, you were the main disciplinarian in essence for the Article 15s and the corps.
I had a few incidents that I wish hadn't happened. I had a kid that traded a bottle of wild turkey or something for a 45 caliber grease gun at the time. I don't know if you know what a grease gun is. I've forgotten the designation of it. We weren't even using it in the Army at the time, and I'm not sure where it even came from. But it was a little machine gun that's sort of almost like an Uzi of today, but it had a little round chamber on it. And it cost about $20 to make it, and half that was the barrel. So, but at any rate, he traded it to some Marine for a bottle of booze. And when he was cleaning the weapon that night, it's a blowback operated weapon, and when he was cleaning the weapon, it discharged several times and it killed the kid in the next bunk. And of course, that was a little bit of a problem when you have to accompany the commander trying to write to somebody's wife or mother to tell them that their son had died as a result of an accident like that. But things like that are tough. We had I had a lot more marijuana incidents after my men were up in the Quantry Marine Base area up in the DMZ, up near the DMZ, with marijuana. Never got any hard drugs, hardline drugs, not in 67, but we had a lot of pot and pot smoking at that time. And I had a few cases as a battalion commander come to me for punishment for possession, smoking marijuana, smoking pot, and the same other. And these people were disciplined. A lot of them got company punishment, but they were second or third offender, then they came up to me for either a special or no general court-martials, but special court-martial.
Most of that was handled at the company level, but I'm sure you still had to be aware of what was going on down at that level.
Oh, yes. All the papers had to come up through me when they were forwarded for that type of punishment. So,
why would you think that there was more marijuana once you moved up north? Is it because of close to the fighting, or is it just more available?
I think Cameron Bay was like a very urbanized area. I'm not sure why I didn't get entangled up with much marijuana. At the time, as a materiel officer, I had very little duties associated with the troops. The commanders were policing the troops as far as discipline was concerned, and I was more involved in the operations and what was going on support-wise. And therefore, I wasn't deeply involved. I did have to do for a group an Article 32 investigation on a lieutenant that was stealing cameras and film and stuff and packing it up and sending it home. And he was caught. I did an Article 32 investigation, and I recommended that this kid be allowed to resign his commission and go home instead of being court-martialed for general court-martial. But this poor kid is just a mixed-up little lieutenant. But anyway, I had more opportunities as a commander to get involved with discipline as a battalion commander than I did, certainly than as I did as a material officer. So therefore, it was probably there, but I just wasn't cognizant of it because I didn't get involved in any of it. And I didn't see any of it at night or any place like that. And none of the officers that I associated with was involved in anything like that when I was in Vietnam.
So it was mainly lower enlisted, D4 and below probably?
Very, yes. I have walked into GP medium tents where troops were sleeping and things like that, and I could, you know, you could smell it in a heartbeat. And so I knew it was there. And I would leave and I would call it to the attention of a first sergeant or a platoon sergeant. I said, "There's somebody's in there smoking pine. We need to find out who it is." And so I turned it over to the company commanders and some of their NCOs to take care of it. So.
How widespread do you think the problem? I mean, was it, you know, about 10 people out of the battalion or half a battalion?
Oh, I think it was very slight. If I was guessing, I would say way less than 10%, probably 5%.
So it wasn't something that consumed your time?
No, it was nothing. No, it sure wasn't. It was just every once in a while thing, as a matter of fact.
Now, you mentioned some casualties. You've taken some at once you got to the Marine base, and some when you were at the village near Cameron Bay. How many casualties did your unit take during the time you were the commander?
Well, I was I had 1,400 troops, and I took in the 5 months or so that I was in with the unit, not counting the 30 days or so it took us to get us into a position. Four and a half or 5 months, I took 96 casualties, and only one death, though. We were rocketed almost nightly up in Quang Tri area. Rocket attacks. We took rocket attacks over Wonder, coming in on Wonder Beach, we got rocketed. So most of that was rocket attacks. I was driving between my battalion headquarters and Camp Eagle, which was like 45 miles, and my driver and I was we were fired upon by a small arms fire out of a cemetery of all places. But a couple of BC or somebody was in there hiding behind some tombstones or something. But at any rate, we just kept going.
Did your portion of the perimeter ever get attacked and probed, or was it just mainly rocket?
We had no, we put out, every night we put out, listening, when I first pushed this out, I sent some of my NCOs out to obtain some equipment that we didn't have, night vision scopes and some things that we didn't have that I thought we needed. We also needed some special sound power phones so I could put out listening posts. I put out listening posts every night about 150 yards in front of my line, so if somebody's coming in, I might hear them and have them hide out there. And even if somebody passed them coming in, they were to just lay low and be quiet, let us know.
So combat service support became combat pretty quickly.
Yes. We had perimeter, and we put up some tanglefoot and some wire with that little engineer detachment that was attached to me. And we put up claymore mines. And one night, I was at the CP. They said that they saw some movement to their front, but we had no reports from the listening post. And a guy came in and said, "On my starlight scope, I see somebody walking across our front. It looks like they have an ammunition box on their head." And that sometimes they carried things up on top of their head and just balanced them like Africans do, but if they were heavy. And so I said, "Well, pick." I told the operator, one of the officers that was on duty up at the command post at that hour of the night, I just happened to be there talking to him. I said, "Tell him to pick out one guy and try to pick this guy off." And we fired one shot, and we forgot to tell everybody else on our front that we were about to fire one shot. And my whole section opened up with, we probably fired 10,000 rounds and never hit anything. But at any rate, what we did was we shot up our wire and a whole bunch of stuff. And I think we even fired one Claymore. We had to go out and repair all of our lines the next morning. But we never did get really attacked through our particular section. As a matter of fact, things started tailing off like that. But there was a large ammunition storage area about 6 miles away, and I had a couple of three or four troops up there working during the daytime, and we were repairing cranes and rough terrain forklifts that were being used to move ammunition around, because we moved a lot of ammunition around. And it was rocketed during the daytime, and they caught a hold of this ammunition dump, and it blew sky high, and it was, you could see it for miles and miles around, and it wiped out all my rough terrain forklifts and cranes that I had up there. But we didn't get anybody injured in that little action, but we were fortunate.
You're probably the best person to answer a question like this. The equipment that you had and the equipment that you repaired. I know you mentioned the engines on the 5 tons of Medusa hats were less than about 1,000 miles. How would you say overall the equipment that the U.S. Army put out in the Vietnam War was, and stand up to it? Was it good enough for the effort or not?
Well, I would say it was about average. It's probably not as good as it was today. The equipment that we had in Vietnam, in my opinion, in many cases was not well suited to fight that type of war, in that we were driving 5 tons and deuce and a halfs over roads that would just shake them to pieces, ruts as deep as a man almost, and we had to put braces on the fenders because the fenders shook till they fell off. And the dust and an environment of the travel for these five, even the dump trucks that were in the engineer battalions that we were repairing that used these Continental multi-fuel engines, a multi-fuel engine being either gasoline or diesel, you could feed either one through it, and there was a fuel injected. So the M113 armored personnel carrier that day was mostly of aluminum, and if anything hit it, a satchel charge on the roof of it would just blow the roof right out the bottom, and if there's anybody in there with it, it just crushed them. And while I was up on the DMZ, a unit from the 7th Cavalry circled their little wagons one night, their PCs. There was about a company down there, and they got attacked by a large VC force, and I could see all the illumination rounds and thus trying to light these people up so they could see the VC, but the VC put satchel charges up on top of these PCs, and it just tore them apart, because I went out and placed them all up the next day or two. My units went out and picked them up, and I went out and looked at some of these PCs. So some of that equipment was not as well suited as like the vehicles we have today, the Bradley or the Abrams tank, the M1 tank. It didn't hold up as well. And those 113s were gasoline driven. And I mean, when you get hit with a gasoline tank, it blows up big time. So some of that equipment was not. The weapons that we had, the artillery weapons, the small arms stuff was as good or superior to what the enemy had as far as weapons are concerned.
You didn't have any problems with the 16, that the first versions of it?
No, the 16 or the AR-15 or whatever they call that thing. I forgot. That's right. The AR-15, which was later became the M-16 after they modified it a little bit. It was a pretty fine weapon. I didn't like it. I didn't carry one in Vietnam. As a matter of fact, when I got up on Quantry Marine Base, all I had was issued was a 45 caliber pistol, and as a commander, and I said, I'm never going to shoot this. So I cleaned it real good. I carried a shoulder holster. I wrapped it up in plastic, and I had the troops go steal me an M2 carbine. and that's what I carried. And that's because I was going to shoot them a long way off. I'm not shooting them with a 45 that close.
So, troops acquire you at any.
Right. Yeah. I had the troops acquire me when.
And your sergeant major was there to protect you, of course.
Yes, the sergeant major was. He was a good guy. I sent the supply sergeant in one day to. We put up this. We dug out a command center. We dug it out with a bulldozer from this detachment and put it on our little command center underground. We ran our lines out to our listening post from there. But I told him, I said, we really need some ice. So I had the supply sergeant deal with the Marines to get an ice machine and a 10 kW generator. So when he went out to acquire all this other stuff, he got me an M2 carbine while he was over there negotiating. So
not only down south, but up north, you had all the comforts at home as well.
That's right, all the comforts at home. And we had to get two mortars. Nobody in our unit knew how to use a mortar, but that night that I thought I had somebody walking on my perimeter out there that was a VC, I called for some illumination from the support from the Marines, and they told me that they had to go to Corps to get permission to fire a mission like that. I said, you've got to be kidding me. I said, I got somebody out here walking. And at any rate, I had my troops go get some 60-millimeter mortars, but I forbid them to get any HE ammunition. I just got illumination rounds. And whenever we had a problem in our front, we just fired our own illumination, just a little 60-millimeter illumination rounds.
So as a commander, you're able to adapt to your surroundings and what equipment you didn't have, you acquired.
Yes, what equipment I didn't have, I acquired.
What did you think about the enemy soldiers that you encountered? I know you probably didn't come up close and personal, but...
The only enemy soldiers I encountered were either wounded or dead. As far as me being as close to me to you, I saw some in the distance a couple of times, and those I saw some run from that graveyard I talked about earlier when they took off. They fired a couple of rounds at my Jeep, missed the Jeep. One of them went through the windshield, but they took off running just as soon as they fired because I guess they thought we were going to fire back at them or something. But anyway, I never really got close to them. To the VC, you know, I could see a lot of tracer rounds coming from their weapons, but they were a long way off.
How would you evaluate their ability to fight? You weren't enough encounters with them.
Well, I think they had a lot more capability to fight than we ever gave them credit for. The supplies and equipment coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, they may bring down a rocket launcher and 50 guys carrying 6 rounds apiece coming down 50 yards apart all night long down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They got the job done, and it might have taken them a lot longer. It was a lot labor intensive, but they got the job done and they got the equipment that they needed. And they fought a guerrilla type war and they did it well, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, what did you think when you were in Cameron Bay and they said, okay, go up to the DMZ? What was your initial reaction as to what you were going to encounter, the enemy?
Well, first of all, I was kind of honored for being selected as a battalion commander, as a major, because all battalion commanders are lieutenant colonel. So, but at any rate, I did sit down and say, well, this could be it, because I was going to a place where the fighting was going to be hot and heavy, and that's when I mentioned that Kaysan was a little Marine Corps hell thing that they thought was going to be a Jin Bin Phu that was over at the end of Route 9, just south of the DMZ, which is that area where they put those people in there. So I knew that I was going from an urbanized area that was almost like living in Sun Lakes, Arizona, almost. To an area where there could be a lot more fighting, and it turned out to be that was true. Getting rocketed almost every night means that you had to sleep inside a sandbag enclosure most of the time. But anyway, I think most of the troops in the battalion headquarters had sort of the same feelings, that they were a little bit concerned and nervous about going in. But we managed to calm them down. And I think the experiences of taking in a battalion headquarters before some of the units, the companies arrived, was good. And the fact that we got, as soon as we came ashore, we said, you guys dig and dig fast and get under the best you can. And it's really tough to maintain vehicles and artillery pieces and weapons and radios when the old gong could go off any time for a rocket attack and you have to jump under something a day or night. The worst I've ever had was when I got I was in the outhouse doing my daily functions when I got a rocket around that came just a few feet from my this outhouse and it took the screen wire out of the top part. And I'm sitting there trying to get my pants up. But at any rate, it was different. I knew it was going to be different, and I was nervous about it, but I think what we did was we said, this is what we got to do. We got to do it, and we got to do a good job and get up there. The problems were, the biggest problem I had was the delay of getting up there. I had troops that were anxious about it, and that just gives you 2 weeks of sitting at Da Nang on the beach worried about where you're going to go. I guess in some respect we're saying, hey, we've been delayed so we don't have to do this, but at the same time, it gives you more time to think about it.
Well, with that, did you tell your wife, that you had a wife and kids at home, did you tell them you were going to a more hostile area? How was the whole...
Yes, I told them it was going to be a little bit more dangerous and in my letters. And of course, at that particular time, though, by the way, I had just met Judy in Hawaii for R&R, and I spent in between my Cameron Bay tour and about in early January, right after New Year's or so, I met Judy in Hawaii, and we spent a nice week in Hawaii. And at that time, I knew where I was going, so a lot of that I did face to face. I told her that it was going to be a lot different, and that there may be some times when I couldn't. I wrote her every day, every night, sometime. I said, there may be a day or two when you won't hear from me, but I don't think that ever happened. I think that I was busy even when we were rocketed. I got a letter off, but the letters might have, she said she would go along and get no letters for 3 or 4 days, and then she'd get 5 at once. So that's just the way the mail worked. It was a lot worse after Cameron Bay up on the DMZ because the APOs didn't work as well or as efficient in combat zones as they did in big cities.
So you were a career military officer, and I'm sure your wife was almost used to the fact that you were sometimes going to be gone for extended periods of time.
Yeah, well, and plus we had, she went to Tulsa, Oklahoma to her grandmother's house. And it was really nice of her grandmother to take her and three small boys, because they were like, the oldest was only like first grader, 6, and they went down 6, you know, 4 and 3 or so. So they were pretty young. But her time was also occupied. That was sort of good, taking care of those three boys and taking care of her grandmother, and trying to make sure those three boys didn't drive her grandmother crazy was good. So that occupied her time. But of course, they're always watching the news, and the news about the Vietnam War was, at that particular time, was not always good, because that was right after Tet Offensive, and we were taking quite a few casualties at that particular time in Vietnam. In 67, 68, it was pretty bad. So,
what was the, were you able to judge or gauge the American reaction in Vietnam about Vietnam?
Only through the, what do they call it, the Yellow Bird? It was the handout version of the Stars and Stripes that circulated around Vietnam. The newspaper, with whatever news you were getting off the wires, like UPI, API, and those types of things. And the maintenance battalion, even as a commander in Vietnam, we didn't get much intelligence information. So a lot of the information we got on how the war was going, we got out of newspapers. So off the Yellow Bird, or I forgot what we call that little newspaper, that little scandal sheet. But it was okay. It gave some news from home, and the guys liked to read that. article on paper news, some sports scores of what was going on, this and that. There was very little in there about all the controversy and the people going to Canada to avoid the draft and blah, blah, and so on. But there was some of that information in there, but not much.
Did Judy mention much of that in her letters, or was it mainly just kids do this?
No, I don't know. I don't think Tulsa, Oklahoma was a big center of activities as far as anti-Vietnam demonstrations went. And it certainly wasn't like Washington, D.C. or someplace, or L.A. or someplace like that was very big in that type of thing. Tulsa, Oklahoma is kind of like a quiet oil town.
Is there anything that you haven't mentioned that sticks out in your mind about the year you spent in Vietnam?
I think there's some things that I did over there that I probably shouldn't have done, and if I had to do over, I'd probably do a little bit different as a commander, and I might have not had as many casualties or something, but I'm not sure what I could have done at the time. You always wonder whether you did enough or whether the job you did was enough to take care of your people or to make sure you were doing what you were sent there to do. And there's nothing you can do to avoid casualties if there's rockets falling around sort of randomly all over the place, because if they're going to hit you, half the time it was just guy happened to be standing at the wrong place at the wrong time when a rocket hit, that's all. And nothing you can do about that. But every once in a while I think of something, I say, well, we should have tried that. And that might be something that would be tried today, but we didn't even know about it then. So you always have second thoughts and second guesses of what's going on. But basically, I don't think that there's anything I can think of that I would really change much about doing. And I don't think I really had a hard time in Vietnam, as hard as many people had. I mean, certainly spending 6 months in Cam Ranh Bay was like going to the beach. We spent our Sunday afternoons at the beach, but the last 4 months or so up on the, I was glad to leave, and as a matter of fact, 2 days before I was supposed to leave Vietnam, I went down to the Marines and got on a C-130 and went to Cam Ranh Bay and spent 2 nights with my old unit and all the guys just before I shipped out home, and I left from Cam Ranh Bay Airport. Air base at Cam Ranh Bay. They had contract flights flying people in and out.
As you were leaving, what did you think? How did you feel like what you accomplished or the reason the U.S. was there? What was your feelings about the whole experience?
Well, at that point in time, I knew that I was there for a very unpopular war, and I was going home and could take some grief from people because I had read enough, a few of the articles that about the demonstrations and what was going on. But most of the real demonstrations and things that came along from the McNamara era came along after I got home. And a lot of that started up after I got home. So it even got worse after I got home for the next 2 or 3 years. Though, when I arrived back home, though, I was greeted greatly by the neighbors and everybody in town. Big signs up, welcome home. Welcome home, Daddy, from the kids across the whole front yard and stuff. It was kind of neat.
Was that in Tulsa or was that?
That was in Tulsa when I... But I flew into to Seattle, Tacoma, and the next day I got put on leave and I flew to and met Judy in Oklahoma City and spent 2 days in Oklahoma City just with Judy before we went to Tulsa where the kids were with the grandmother. So I had a couple days with her in Oklahoma City. As a matter of fact, I had her aunt and uncle lived in Oklahoma City, and they gave us her house, and they bought us a dinner in a revolving restaurant, a nice restaurant in downtown Oklahoma City, so it was kind of nice. And then we drove on over to Tulsa to the kids, and when I got there, the neighbors and the big signs were out across the whole front of the house, like, welcome home, Daddy, and blah, blah, and so on. So I was greeted very well in there. So I never personally got involved, not one time, in any incident where somebody said, why did you go to Vietnam, you killer, murderer of children and women, and that illegal war, why did you fight, blah, blah. I never once.
Well, you stayed in the military for 15 years after that, so you pretty much went from post to post after that, so you were surrounded by other people who were in the same incidents as you.
Yes, that's true.
Now, as a whole, how do you think or how do you feel about the U.S. involvement in Vietnam? Was it necessary? Was it good?
I guess after the fact, I would say no. We probably even shouldn't have been there. But we were sent there, and we were sent there in good faith by our country, and we went over there and did the best job we could. But I think the political arena of the time made the wrong decision to put us into Vietnam. That was a little bit quick. I don't think that if that all happened again today, I don't think we would go in to a Vietnam conflict. I know we just went into an Iraq in Kuwait, but I think it was a little bit, the circumstances were a little bit different, and our national interests were a little different. I'm not sure our national resolve and national interests were on our side in the Vietnam War. I don't think that our national interests, whether Vietnam was communist or non-communist, I don't think we had any national interests at all in Vietnam. And so why did we go in there? I mean, we had advisors there for years, but then we built up to half a million troops over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years. I don't think any of our national interests were at stake in Vietnam at all.
Well, and just real quickly on something, the military leaders, and not the political leaders in Washington, but the military leaders. How do you think they conducted the war? Did they do it the proper way? Was it things they could have done differently? I know you can't second guess everybody, but
I think our military leaders did the very best they could under the circumstances, and I think they were reined in by the political powers that be at the time. There is absolutely no way to fight a guerrilla type warfare without actually doing something like we did in the Iraq war. You got to just charge off and take his country over. You might hand it back to him right after you cut across it, but you can't, unless we invaded North Vietnam and took it over and stopped all that stuff. You can't do it by bombing North Vietnam and bombing the jungles and defoliating the jungles. People could hide in those jungles in Vietnam forever. You'd never get them out. So.
What did you take away from your year in Vietnam? Do you think it helped your career or helped you personally, or did it help you at all?
Well, my wife says I'm the only Army officer that she knows of that went to Vietnam and gained weight. When I was at Camp Ron Bay, we ate well, even though we took that morning pill every day for malaria, and we spent a lot of time in the John thereafter. We ate well, and I think my experience in Vietnam made me a better person, and also it helped me understand a little bit about the involvement of my own military career and the progression that I was going to take in the military. I think it was personally good for me. It was certainly good for my career because I would never have made 06 if I hadn't been in the Vietnam War. And I think some of those things about doing a good job at at Cam Ranh Bay so that the powers that be in Vietnam selected me to be a battalion commander. To me, said that I was doing a good enough job while there, because that had nothing to do with my personnel records and things that was going on back in the States, because that didn't even count as far as being selected as battalion commander and getting your old ticket punched, as we called it, as far as your career goes. That was done locally in Vietnam by local area commanders, and later on reported up the channel as to what your assignments actually were. I'm in the driveway with my golf cart. I think it made me a better person because, A, I became more worldly. I knew what was going on in Vietnam, though I didn't get a lot of intelligence about what was happening. But I knew that when we started bombing the North, I knew how the war was going in general, as much as a maintenance battalion commander ought to know. I certainly got enough intelligence to do my particular job, which is on a need-to-know type basis of what was going on in the war. And I became a lot more knowledgeable when I was selected to be a battalion commander and went up north, where there was a lot of fighting raging in the upper north, and there was a lot down in the delta regions of Vietnam at the time that I was there. But the heaviest fighting was going on up in the north and then going west over towards the Anshan Valley from Quezon. So.
And looking back, if you look at like Jane Fonda, or when President Carter pardoned all the people who dodged a draft, how do you feel about the demonstrators and the people who did things that were in contrast to what you had to do?
I guess I look upon this a little bit different than most people. I guess I would fight for their right to do whatever they thought they needed to do to state their opinions. I would defend them, their right to do that to the end. I really would. But I also think that what I was doing was right. I was sent over there by my country, and that's what I was in the Army. I was a career military person. They called upon me to go over there and do a job. I went over there and do my job. Now, I don't particularly like it, because I don't think Jane Fonda is a very good patriot, and it certainly didn't bid well for our country. But I would stand up for her right to speak out and say what's on her mind. I think that's a First Amendment, and if we want to criticize our president or whatever we want to do, I think we ought to be able to do that. And now, there are better ways sometimes to do that, through the courts or through the laws, and get our laws amended in our country, or get better representatives, or vote for a different person. And that doesn't seem to be fast enough for some people, so therefore they go downtown and demonstrate. But I guess everybody has an opinion, though I don't like it, I think I like to hear them. And if somebody has an opinion I don't like, I say, hey, I think you're wrong. But you know, you're entitled to your opinion. That's the way I look at it. I look at the world that way. I don't. When somebody has an opinion different from mine, I don't hate them for it. So therefore, I don't hate Jane Fonda. I certainly don't respect her opinion, and I think it's a bad thing that what she did as far as turning people against. We don't have any flag wavers anymore. We don't have any patriots anymore. And that's a bad thing. That's a bad thing. And to overcome something like that's hard. If you have too many Jane Fondas, it's difficult.
That's all I have. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
Well, I hope I gave you enough information to write something down. I don't know if I did or not. If you're looking for blood and gut stories, I don't have any of those. But I'm not sure what you're doing in your paper, but I tried to tell you everything I tried to tell you.